Now, live from the Valley Free Radio's primary school, it's the Enviro Show on WXOJLP 103.3 FM, Northampton.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Churn world serves its own needs. Dummy, serve your own needs. Feed it up a knock, speak, grunt, no strength. The ladder starts to clatter with fear. Bite down. High wire and a fire representing seven games in a government for hire and a combat site. Let the West are coming in a hurry with the Furies breathing down your neck. Team, my team, reporters, babble, Trump, tethered crop. Look at that. No plane. Fine. Then, overflow. Population common. Slice and burn, return, listen to yourself churn. Locking in, uniform and book burning, blood letting every motive escalate, automotive centerate. Light a candle, light a motor, step down, watch your heel crush, crush. Uh-oh, this means no fear, cavalier, renegade, steer clear. A tournament of lies. Offer me solutions, offer me alternatives, and I decline. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world.
Earthlings, it's the Gimme Shelter Enviro Show. I'm one of your co-hosts, Dio. I'm here with...
I'm Glenn Ayers.
I'm Jean Grossel.
Yes, and it's Adjective Burden Tuesday. It's also Fat Tuesday, Shreve Tuesday, down in New Orleans. It's Overly Burdened Tuesday, Super Duper Rootin' Tootin', No Gluten Sugar-Free Tuesday. And it's time to exercise your mandate in the Massachusetts primaries.
Or your woman date.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, watch the language,
Oops.
Okay?
Sorry, Gene. Given that this is the Enviro Show, we naturally recommend that you check out... Oh, what happened to that? Am I here? Hello?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Somebody's messing with my volume.
I can't hear my volume. Leave my headphones alone.
Since it's
I'm all the way on the end.
Since it's the Enviro show, check out the Green Rainbow Party at www.massgreens.org. But how about Obama?
I'm a little disillusioned with the whole nuclear contribution issue.
Wasn't that something else?
Oh man.
We'll get into that. That was in the New York Times Sunday, right on the front page, Obama and the nukes. Well, it's also a good time, here in Winterbound, New England, to think about shelter, and especially warm, cozy ones. So while Glenn interviews Becky Camery, author of Yurts, Round and Unbound.
No, it's, look at the title over there.
Well, it says here, Round and Unbound.
Yeah, but that's because you wrote that.
That's because I wrote that. Yurts, Living in the Round.
Living in the Round, yeah.
Mm. And speaking of shelter, Don has put on our pieces of paper for the show a beautiful picture of a very old cave, a very large cave, which looks very drafty and very cold.
It looks like a French
cave.
Yeah,
it looks like
me.
One of the Lacalle. Yeah. But it is very drafty looking.
Right.
But that was good for the air quality, indoor air quality.
That's true. A lot of air exchange.
Yeah, that's right. But if they burn things inside, if they have little fires, bad.
That's why you needed a lot of air exchange, though.
Exactly.
For the smoke.
And there was all that space for murals, too.
Yeah.
As always, we'll also look into the latest assaults on the planet by the Empire and get into a little bit of the EnviroShow echo chamber. But first, as always, it's time for that's right. It's Revenge of the Critters. This week's installment, Moose Attacks Snowmobiles in Canyon Creek.
Yeah, baby.
This is another golden oldie. I had to dig for this one. On December 29, a snowmobiler riding along a groomed trail in the Canyon Creek area came upon a cow moose who subsequently kicked the machine and put its hoof through the sled's hood. John Fraley, spokesman for Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Region 1, says the moose stayed on the path and challenged the sled as the snowmobiler backed off. Sissy. When a couple more snowmobilers came around the bend at the popular recreation area north of Columbia Falls, the moose reportedly reacted the same way, kicking the side of one snowmobile before taking off. This isn't typical behavior of a moose, said Fraley. Even with a calf, they wouldn't typically attack a snowmobile. FWP warden Chris Crane and wildlife conflict specialist Eric Wenham investigated the scene, finding tracks but no moose. Shortly after the initial incident, a groomer smoothing the trails in the same area reported that he came upon a moose that refused to budge, even after hearing and seeing the machine churning along the path. Fraley said there are reports of a young moose accompanying the cow. End of story.
A moosing.
A mama moose.
Drive-by moosing.
She says, get out with those snowmobiles, which are a gigantic problem in our public lands, I might add.
Would you feel so badly about them if people pedaled?
Pedaled would be good, but
Bicycle, snowmobiles.
That would be great.
It's the motor part of it that you don't like.
Yeah. And the smell. And the noise. The smell and the noise.
But that comes from the motor.
Hey, whoa. Are there bicycle snowmobiles?
I don't know. I think we should.
And it's not just the guys on them that smell. It's the engine exhaust.
They smell like beer and those guys.
Yeah.
No, they don't.
We should talk to the pedal people about bicycle snowmobiles.
Yeah, I think bicycle snowmobiles would be good.
That would be great.
All right. You want to talk about the primaries today? A little talk?
Well, I just have to say that I'm just really disappointed that Dennis Kucinich is not in the primaries, because that's the only thing that's made me want to go to the primaries in the past.
Or so. John Edwards.
Well, I would have gone to the primaries. I would have voted if John Edwards had been running.
Yeah. Why did he drop out?
I think he got beaten out.
Yeah.
The money and stuff.
Not enough money.
Well, not just that. It's the corporate media sidelined him.
Yeah, well, especially with Kucinich. Yeah. He wasn't even allowed to go in the debates.
Yeah. They're not part of that corporate elite group down at the center.
Yeah.
And they would have challenged this way of governing without any political sovereignty on the part of the people, which is what has been going on for the past 20 years, and I think they would have fought that.
Yeah.
So they might have encouraged us to have a revolution in the streets, though I very much doubt whether Edwards would have done that, but it would have been great. And every time there's any threat of that, then the corporations come through and the old elite establishment comes through and put somebody up that they know will not touch that.
That's right.
So if you want class politics, honey, we got it.
Yeah. Well, another group that mainstream media has buried is the Green Rainbow Party. And they're on the ballot. You could go to your place of voting and ask for the Green Party ballot. And on there is a bunch of people running, and one of whom is Cynthia McKinney, who you remember was was the only person, I think, that voted against. She first came out and when Bush was in stole the election, she was one of the first people to speak up about that, and one of the first people to speak up against the invasion of Iraq. So she's running along with, let's see, I guess Nader's name is on the Massachusetts Green Party ballot. Elaine Brown, a former Black Panther.
Black Panther.
Kat Swift, an activist on publicly financed elections. Cynthia McKinney and Kent Mesplay, Native American environmental engineer activist.
Now, when I went into to the primary tonight in Leverett, I had to either go for a pink or a
no, they had a green ballot.
Well, they on you the know side. They said I either had to declare right there as a Democrat or a Republican, and they only had two ballots.
I saw a green ballot sitting on the side of the desk.
Really?
Yeah, along with another ballot, which I didn't ask about.
I didn't ask. I should have asked.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying is, you know, not only did these sort of mainstream people like Edwards and Kucinich get sidelined by the media, but the Green Party is like vanished.
Yep.
Even in the liberal media, Air America, you hardly ever hear them mention the Greens.
Yeah.
Well, they're a shadow of them for their former self.
This is true. So anyway, if folks want to hear more about what's going on with the Greens, I had to dig for it. You know, I never got any emails or any messages or listserv yak about.
Yeah, and Cynthia McKinney she's great. A great speaker. She's right on.
Right.
Well, Elaine Brown is going to be speaking here in the next week or two. I don't remember where. But if you've never heard her, you should really hear her. She's very, very good.
Right. Okay, Obama, right? There was an Obama quote in this week's Newsweek, and he asked what he wants to accomplish. By the end of his presidency, he said, ending the war, universal health care, and we will have a bold energy agenda that drastically reduces emissions of greenhouse gases while creating a green engine that can drive growth for many years to come. However,
how green is that green?
I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of green. There was a lot of green from the nukes.
But it's always, how do you get from here to there, and do you have the stamina and the ability to push it? That's the question. Yeah. What's that?
However, front page New York Times, Sunday Times, on nukes, tells us that since 2003, executives and employees of Exelon, which is based in Illinois, have contributed at least $227,700 to Mr. Obama's campaign for the U.S. Senate and for president. Two top Exelon officials, Frank Clark, executive vice president, and John Rogers, Jr., director, are among his largest fundraisers. Another Obama donor, John W. Rowe, chairman of Exelon, is also chairman of the Nuclear Energy Institute, the nuclear power industry's lobbying group based in Washington. Let's see. In addition, Mr. Obama's chief political strategist, David Axelrod, has worked as a consultant to Exelon. So Obama's pretty deep into nukes, and Hillary says that she's agnostic on nukes. All right. Is that Becky? Yeah? All right. Well, while we're waiting to set up for our interview with Becky, we'll move on into a little of some shelter stuff I have. We'll be talking, of course, about yurts and living in the round. But I got some other yurt, rather some other shelter info. This also from the New York Times, January 27th. It was a story about prefab earth-friendly homes, quote unquote. The architect Laszlo Kiss, which sounds like an assumed name to me, has designed a four-bedroom prototype in Sag Harbor, of all places on Long Island, that he says uses the constant temperature of the earth and the power of the sun for heat and electricity. A house, which he is calling About Saving a Planet, or ASAP, was built in Pennsylvania in a Pennsylvania factory and delivered in three sections by truck to a quarter acre in a quarter acre lot at Sag Harbor. The foundation was delivered separately in pre-insulated concrete slabs, and the builders are finishing the interior and exterior details on the site. He has paid close attention to cost. The article says at $265 a square foot, fully installed, the high on design, low on carbon emission ASAP home is a bargain. Well, for Sag Harbor, that is a bargain, I suppose. And further on, it says the house is distinctive mostly for its green components, a geothermal heating system and solar panels. The panels to be installed on a nearly flat roof will power the house during the day and feed electricity back into the grid in the evening. Mm-hmm. And the geothermal system is predicated on the fact that below the frost layer, that's about 6 feet in Long Island, the Earth's temperature remains relatively constant, which is 55 degrees. Water passing through pipes laid deep underground picks up the heat or deposits it before heading back to a heating and cooling device in the house.
Yeah. See, I think these new systems that people are putting together are very, very wonderful. But I wish there were something that could be done with old houses like the one I live in. When I tried to make it more green and more efficient, the difficulty that I ran into was just extraordinary, and the cost of it was just out of sight. So I think that I wish some of these really smart technique people would get busy on trying to figure out what we can do about the houses we already live in.
Yeah, because there's a lot of them out there.
Oh, yeah.
Have you had, like, an energy audit?
Oh, yeah, a long time ago.
They didn't have any good suggestions?
Well, they had the same suggestions. Change your windows, which we've done. Mm-hmm. Add a storm door here, which we did. Cut out your phantom power, which we're trying to do.
Yeah.
You know, change to the different light bulbs. We've done all of that. We've done all of that.
Insulation.
We have lots of insulation. Yeah. We even have sidewall insulation. We've done everything, but we still use a hell of a lot of oil.
Yeah.
Hey, you got Becky on the phone?
Yeah, we do, but we're going to play a tune first, aren't we? Well, let's just make sure we have Becky on the line here.
Well, we have to have Becky on the line.
We'll punch her through.
Hi there, I'm here.
Oh, good. Good. You want to hear some music before we start yakking?
Yeah, we got a tune lined up to play.
Apropos to what we're talking about is the Rolling Stones, Give Me Shelter. Thank you. That's an Andy Warhol song.
All right. Welcome to the Enviro Show, Becky.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, yeah. I'm Glenn, and with me here is Dio and Jean.
Hi, Becky.
Hi, Becky.
Hi, Jean. Hi, Dio.
And Becky, can you introduce yourself to my co-hosts here and tell us where you're calling from and give us the background?
All right. I'm calling from the mountains of North Idaho, the little town of Sandpoint, and it is snowing here. We have about 5 feet of snow already.
Oh, nice.
Added. It's a record winter. And I'm the author of a book called Yurts Living in the Round,
which I have in front of me here in the studio.
There's very pretty pictures in it, Becky.
I'm showing it to the microphone here for our listening audience. This book is full of delicious-looking pictures. Mm-hmm. I just have to say that.
Thank you.
I'm also I'm a yurt lover myself, so I have a little bit of yurt history in me. And are you living in a yurt? Are you calling from a yurt?
I'm actually not right now.
Okay.
I'm house sitting for someone, but in fact, I've been on the road so much during this last year that I didn't need my yurt, so I took it down and I gave it to a friend who was doing a remodel, and it's just on loan. And then this next spring I'll put it back up again.
Nice. I tell you my history. When I lived out in Colorado as a grad student, a friend of mine and I sewed up some yurts, some 26-foot diameter yurts. We did the sidewalls on my antique Singer sewing machine. I'd have to change the bobbin about 4 times just to do one seam across. You know, I don't know what the circumference of the perimeter of a 26-foot diameter yurt is, but it's pretty long, 70-some feet.
Yeah.
And we did 3 yurts like that, and they went up into the Never Summer Wilderness area west of Fort Collins, Colorado. There's a ski yurt-to-yurt system out there.
Never Summer Nordic.
Yeah, Never Summer Nordic, exactly. Yep. Right. So we didn't do the wood part. We did the canvas and the roof part of it.
Wow, that's quite a history.
Yeah, and I still have one, which has never been set up. I've carried it with me all these years. It's been 15 years or more. I've been carrying it around everywhere I go. I haven't made the frame for it or anything, but I still have the sidewall and the roof. So I love yurts, and I really love this book. It has. Why don't you talk about the different sections and what inspired you to come up with the whole idea?
Okay. Well, your listeners are welcome to go online and look at Amazon to see what the book looks like.
Yurts Living in the Round.
Yurts Living in the Round. If you look under yurts, it's the first one that will come up. And my story is that I started living in yurts in the early 90s. And yurts had the flexibility that I needed for a pretty semi-nomadic lifestyle. And then also they were very affordable. And I realized that it afforded me this, warm, embracing, lovely shelter that I could live in and even own without taking out a mortgage from a bank. And as you know, most people put something like 30 to 50% of their income into their shelter needs. And so, after living in yurts for a number of years, I went looking for information on yurts, and it really wasn't out there. So I wanted to get that info out, and I also wanted to give people a sense of the magical feel that you understand, the magical feel of yurts and what it's like to be inside. And so I worked really hard to make sure that it was a picture book, a coffee table photo book, so that people could actually see and get a sense of what yurts are like.
How do you keep it warm in the wintertime?
Well, you can use almost anything that you would in a conventional home, but most people use either wood heat or propane. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the best forms of heat is actually radiant heat, you know, where you'd have a concrete slab floor, mm-hmm. which is permanent, but it's a wonderful form of heat, and it works really well in a yurt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, you know, some people may not know what yurts are, which is hard to believe, but I spent some time living in teepees out in Colorado and New Mexico and different areas. Not a lot of time, but they were, you know, very primitive. Living in a teepee is a very primitive thing to do. But a yurt, although it's the same kind of concept, I guess you could say, as, you know, a temporary shelter could be, there really is not much comparison between a yurt and a teepee. At least the teepees that I stayed in, you know, with the big hole in the top and the water dripping down everywhere. So can you explain a little bit about, you know, basically just give a picture for people who are listening of where the yurt came from and what it looks like when it's put up?
Sure. And I do have a whole chapter in the book on the origins of the yurt. They originated in Central Asia in a band of land about a 1,000 miles wide that stretches from Turkey and Iran in the west all the way to China in the east, so about one quarter of a way around the planet. And this form of shelter was developed by nomadic herders or tribes people, so it was very portable. And the difference between the teepee and the yurt is that the yurt has a trellis wall, somewhat like a baby gate, so it expands and contracts. And so that's the wall, is this trellis, and then the roof is roof poles that meet in a center ring. It's a very strong structure because the whole structure is held in tension between the center ring at the top and then a band that goes around the outside of the wall, at the top of the wall, and integrates the wall and the roof. In Central Asia, the covering is actually made out of felted wool. Mm-hmm. It's taken from their herds. And in North America, because the felted wool doesn't work in our climate, we use architectural fabrics.
Does that help? Yeah, yep. And they're kind of cylindrical, short cylindrical with a, you know, a squashed cone kind of roof, I would say.
Right, like a muffin, maybe.
A muffin shape.
Or
something
a cupcake.
Like. Yeah.
More like the muffin top, you know.
Yeah.
Muffin top.
Yeah. Now, there are different kinds of yurts in your book. That there's, you know, what would I guess would say the very primitive ones, the traditional ones. And then there's a section on ones that are made out of panels instead of, I guess, a fabric kind of sidewall.
And there's one of them or two of them that look like they're out of the New York Times Style magazine or something.
Yes. That's the other end of the spectrum.
Yeah, some of them look like spaceships almost.
Right, and the spaceship ones actually originated in Maine with Bill Copperthwaite, and those are the tapered wall yurts, and they really look like muffins.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's a whole section on the you know, what I would say would be traditional for this country, which would be the fabric wall, sidewall, and the lattice that you talked about, like the baby gate kind of thing. And those we could set up in really a few hours, maybe 4 hours. We could set up the yurt, you know, on a basketball court or something like that when we were building them.
Right. And
it was pretty amazing. It all fit in the back of a pickup truck, a small pickup truck. And we'd go set it up on a basketball court and make sure everything fit together and then go back and make some modifications, you know, before we took them up into the Rockies and set them up there.
Yeah, away from your sewing machine.
Yeah. The one thing about these yurts that, you know, I wanted to talk with you about specifically is how when you're living in one, you're not so disconnected from the world as
right.
you are living in a house. Like right now we're in the basement of a big brick building. And,
uh-huh.
I mean, we have a window, but otherwise we're completely disconnected from the world. But when you're living in a yurt, you know, the first thing you hear in the morning in the springtime is an incredible orchestra of birds singing, and you're almost living outside. It's more like living in a tent than living in a house. So can you talk about that?
Well, I think that is the most. Someone asked me what my favorite thing was about living in a yurt myself, and I think what you're talking about is the soundscape. It's a drawback in the city because you don't necessarily want to hear the sirens going off in a city neighborhood. But when you're living more rurally, to be able to hear the coyotes singing at night and hear the creek rushing by 24/7 is an amazing thing. So I think that's one of the things that people notice the most about the yurts. And, you know, one, people talk about, you know, nature deprivation today. You know, one thing that's developed in our modern housing is a sense of protection against nature. So we more or less build our homes to be fortresses against nature. And a yurt really provides a different experience for people of connectedness to nature. And it actually also, you know, coming from the Central Asian tribal background, it also brings with it a history of connection to tribe and family that happens inside of the yurt, because it is a round shelter and it's an open shelter.
We're talking with Becky Kemery, who's the author of Yurts, Living in the Round. Becky, I had a question here in the Five College area in the mid-Connecticut River Valley. We have a yurt at Hampshire College. When this radio station first started, they did a training on from the radio setup that they had in that yurt, and it's a permanent yurt. So they're all yurts aren't movable, right? There's people who live in yurts permanently, right?
Right. Well, that yurt is one of, I believe, is one of Bill Copperthwaite's tapered wall yurts. Those are very common in New England, and also there are a lot at universities. I suspect that's the type of yurt that you were in. And the beauty of those particular yurts, they have, as I'm sure you remember, they have a really wonderful feel, and they're great for doing classes in and workshops in. But the other aspect of those is that they're easy to build. They were designed so that they could be built by someone without a lot of carpentry experience. And Bill Copperthwaite with the Yurt Foundation in Maine actually sells plans. And the plans are designed so that someone without a lot of experience can sit down and figure them out and actually build their own shelter.
It sounds wonderful to me. I'm sort of out of sync with the my colleagues here, but I have an RV, and the reason why I love my RV is that I can drive it out to some kind of natural place and park, and I'm there amidst the world, and I can look out in the morning and see the moose running around or the birds singing, and it's really wonderful. And the advantage of it is I can go anywhere in it. You know, I can travel it around, and I don't have to set it up and so on. But yurt living would be wonderful for me. I could just imagine what it must be like. You know, if you've ever been to the Theodore Roosevelt National Park in North Dakota,
oh yeah,
it's the most gorgeous place. And to just be able to put up a yurt there and live there for a summer would be wonderful.
Yeah, that would be. Yeah.
Maybe that's what we should do with all of our people running for Congress and make them go out there and live for a week in a yurt and listen to the world and see if they come back with a little bit more sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure one question that always comes up with people when we talk about these kinds of structures is how would the local zoning or building inspectors view these kinds? I mean, they're so different than our traditional, you know, structures. How difficult are they to get through that process? Are you familiar with that?
Well, that's actually the top question in the country, as far as frequently asked questions go.
There you go.
And it's, oh yeah, you nailed it. It's a complicated question because building codes vary from, not just from state to state, they vary from county to county.
Right.
And then your building code official is actually empowered in the codes themselves to interpret the codes pretty much as they choose. So it's a complicated question. There's no, you know, simple and single answer. I did a whole sidebar in the book, you know, a couple of pages just on codes, giving people a process for working through going to their code department, the questions to ask, you know, what they need to find out before they look at purchasing a yurt, and then how a yurt company can help them with the process. In some communities, it's very easy. I happen to live in a county where there are no code restrictions in the county. Once you get inside of the city, there are. So it, you know, it varies from state to state, and it varies from county to county. And really, you know, and of course it varies with the style of yurt. If you're looking at the frame panel wooden yurts, which are basically a stick frame style of building, there's no problem with codes. But, you know, you're talking about the kind of yurts that are more tent-like. They're portable, and they have a trellis wall. So it's unusual, but it's also new to a lot of code officials. They don't really know how to handle it, and they need to be educated. So that's, you know, it's a more complicated process there. And my advice is, you know, to check in with your code department before you purchase and, you know, and find out. And also take some information to them. You know, take the information from the yurt companies that you're looking at and take the book in and show them and explain it to them and let them read. Because I do talk in the book about what a strong structure it is and how well it does with winds and snow loads, things like that. And so it's helpful for a code official to, you know, to be able to sit and read that and learn about it.
But I would think that the most important thing for local local people would be the facilities for going to the toilet and getting rid of your wastewater and things of that sort, if somebody were going to live in it permanently.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just another form of shelter, so there are a variety of ways of dealing with it. And once again, you can put into a yurt pretty much anything that you would put into a conventional home. And that's one of the beauties with a yurt, is there's this enormous range of flexibility. If you're rural, you can live with a sawdust toilet or a septic system. There are a lot of ways to work it. And something that people don't realize at first is that you can put in electricity, you can put in plumbing, you just bring it up through the floor like you would in a conventional home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some of the other questions I'm sure that get raised about yurts is how long would a yurt, you know, like one of these architectural fabric yurts last? You know, if you're going to buy one for, let's say it's $10,000 or $15,000, I don't know what the cost would be, but how long is that going to last?
Yeah, that's a really important question. And you also mentioned cost. I usually tell people that yurts range in cost from $5,000 to $20,000. So, you know, think, you know, about what a new car would cost. That's what a yurt would cost new. And then the wooden structure, the internal structure, lasts indefinitely. But the exterior fabric is usually guaranteed for 10 to 15 years. And usually they'll last maybe 5 years longer than that, unless there's a lot of UV UV situation or a lot of moisture. And then, you know, those fabrics just get replaced. So, and one thing to keep in mind if you're looking at a yurt is that it's really important to buy from a good company, because you are going to be replacing that fabric, and you want to work with a company that's going to be there in 15 years and is going to be easy to work with to replace the fabric.
Mm. And how about the idea that you're living in nature, which, you know, I'm a big proponent of or fan of or whatever, but do you also bring a lot of nature into your yurt with you, you know, like mice and bears and other kinds of critters?
You don't wipe your feet. So that was, that's what happens.
Well, mice and bears are separate issues. Actually, yurts are very weather tight, and Glenn, I'm sure you experienced that if you set them up on a platform tied them into the platform. So they're very tight as far as insects getting in. It would be like a conventional home, you know, through windows, doors left open, if you're not screening the doors off. And then mice. The only time I ever had a problem with mice was when my cat would bring a mouse into the yurt, because it liked to chase the mouse around the circular structure. There were no corners for the mouse to hide in. And I think that's pretty typical experience, that they're pretty tight, and mice often have an easier time getting into a stick frame house than they do a yurt. Bears also... usually yurts are safe against bears. the structure is very strong. In fact, the Kazakh tribal people actually used the yurt frame to hunt tigers. So they'd go near, you know, a brood of tigers. They'd set up the yurt frame and then carry it close to the tigers. And then one of the tigers would become antagonized enough that it would charge the yurt frame, and they would shoot it or spear it or whatever. And the tiger couldn't get in the frame and get at the people. So that's something to remember with bears, is a bear can actually get through the fabric part of the yurt and the insulation and tear that, and you would have to replace that, but they cannot get in the trellis wall. However, someone told me recently there's a company in Nova Scotia that makes traditional yurts, and they had someone ask them a question about polar bears. And apparently with a polar bear, if a polar bear is charging a cabin or a wooden house, you have 6 to 8 minutes to work with before you're going to see that bear inside the house. So a polar bear, her answer was, no, you don't want to use our yurts up in polar bear country. So no with polar bears, but usually with bears there isn't a problem.
Yeah, our bears here are like teddy bear size. Yeah. They're pretty small.
Black
in the east.
Bears.
Black bears, they're pretty small. What's left?
And if you have an air gun, you can chase them away pretty easy.
Yeah. Any other questions from the peanut gallery here?
No.
Yeah. Becky, you want to give us some of your contact information again for folks?
I would love to. My website is yurtinfo.org, and it's being updated. The new updated site should be up in about 2 or 3 weeks. And I have all the yurt companies listed on there. I have a classified section for used yurts and a forum for questions. And then I also have a blog at livinginaround.net. And then the book's title is Yurts, Living in the Round.
And who's the publisher?
The publisher is Gibbs Smith.
Gibbs Smith. They publish a lot of really good stuff too.
They do.
They do. Yeah. They're great. Are you going to be out in the East Coast anytime, doing
a
book tour or anything like
that?
Yeah, you will.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So make sure you come to the Connecticut River Valley here.
Yeah, let us
know.
I will. Let us know you're coming.
We'll have you on the show live.
Yeah. Oh, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, and there's some great bookstores in this area too.
Yes,
in the valley.
Yes, there are.
Yeah.
All right, we've linked to Becky's site on our blog. Just Google in the Enviro Show. Becky Camery, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's been great.
And thank you for doing your show, you know, getting the word out. That is so important.
Yeah, and this will be on our podcast site in, a few days, so you can download it and listen to yourself again.
Thank you.
Okay, yep.
All right,
really nice talking to you.
Good night,
you
Becky.
Too.
Stay warm in all that snow.
All right.
Take care.
Have a good evening.
Yep, bye.
Bye-bye. All right. Becky Camery again. The book is Yurts, Living in the Round. And I think it's time to check out Darth Cheney and see what he's up to.
I'm restarting this.
Huh? Let's see. We have some Darth Cheney info, but first we have to hear the dreaded theme to get... Get it.
Ah, there it is.
Here he comes.
All right, Glenn, give us the news. What's the countdown?
All right, we're going off the website backwardsbush.com. Is my I think my backwards bush countdown timer is the battery has run out. It didn't even last. Didn't even last as long as this regime. But anyway, we're less than a year. Of course, we're down to 349 days, 5 hours, 13 minutes, and 30 seconds at the buzzer. And that's it. Every day is a day less of this, the worst presidency in history.
But every day is a day more of the tragedy that he imposes on us.
Yeah, this country's going to have a hangover for the next 20 years after this binge.
Well, I hope that my battery doesn't run out before we watch them go out the door.
Oh, yeah. Then we'll have a big party the day he goes out the door. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Then again,
I'm going to get me a whole bottle of scotch.
Jail to the thief.
They may not want to go out the door. There may be another incident.
Oh, yeah.
We'll have to postpone the elections. I hear Willie Nelson's been talking about that. Anyway, Bush took a hit from the judge the other day. Bush exempts Navy from environmental law, but that didn't last long.
Yeah,
President
didn't work
Bush out. Had fired another salvo in the ongoing fight pitting the U.S. Navy's use of mid-frequency sonar against whales and other marine mammals that can be harmed by it. Bush tried exempting the Navy from parts of the Coastal Zone Management Act that a federal judge recently found the Navy was violating when it used the powerful sonar off the California coast. And the judge had ordered the Navy to adopt a number of safety measures to protect sensitive marine mammals during the sonar exercises. But then the boy emperor tried to circumvent that. But just what was it, yesterday? We learned that Bush is overriding failed, is overreaching failed. So,
yeah.
Oh, what happened? lost some sound effects there. Anyway, that's
wired
history.
Nuts came off.
Is that what happened?
Yeah.
You told me to get wired nuts, and now look. Are we going to have another electrical fire here? All right. Moving on. Oil shale production in western U.S. with Department of Energy subsidies will prolong dependence upon filthy fossil fuels while destroying the climate, water, and land. And this is another Bush regime big oil scam. Oil shale deposits across 17,000 square miles of Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming hold an estimated 800 billion barrels of oil, more than three times Saudi Arabia's stated reserves. The relatively high cost of producing oil from oil shale has meant that full-scale commercial production has never been economically feasible. With crude oil prices at record highs and conventional oil resources diminishing, the U.S. government energy and interior departments want to jumpstart oil shale production with predictably disastrous environmental
consequences. Yeah, there go the Rockies.
Yep. Both mining and processing of oil shale involve a variety of environmental impacts. There's no oil in oil shale. Instead, it is a substance called kerogen, which is solid and cannot be pumped directly out of the ground. The oil shale must either be mined first and then heated at a high temperature, or heated while still underground and then pumped to the surface as a liquid, still an experimental
process. What kind of energy will heat it?
Yeah, right. Oil?
maybe a, like a precision nuke might do it. Yeah. Now, when I went to graduate school in Colorado in the 80s, this was really a big deal, although it was right at the end of the so-called oil shale boom. And they were talking at the time about really literally mining the entire Rocky Mountain chain for oil shale, you know, how much is out there. And they were talking about doing in situ oil shale mining, which means they blow it up underground and fire it. Basically, you know, burn it underground, and it leaves behind a huge toxic waste, like Superfund site, every time they do it.
All right. Oh, it's still experimental, though, according to this piece.
Yeah.
Where is this piece from?
Yeah.
Grist, I think.
I think we have a whole new fight against nuclear power coming up big time.
Yeah.
I think. And it just seems like we won it once. We have to go fight it again.
All right, so we move on to a bus stop billboard. What do you say?
Yeah, because we got a
time. The clock is running. So we'll go right to it. Thursday, February 7th. It's just day after tomorrow. 7 to 8:30 p.m. Cabin Fever Environmental Hootenanny. Peter Siegel's blend of traditional folk and indie music combined with his Sloop Clearwater roots. You know, when I first read this, I thought it was Pete Seeger.
No, it's not.
No, it's not.
He's the younger version.
Ah, and they make him a compelling modern voice for the environment. And this event is going to be held at the Northfield Mountain Yurt.
Yeah, at the yurt.
Yep, in Northfield, Massachusetts. $5 donation to pre-register. Call 800-859-2960.
Yeah, he's a great musician. Really
good. You've heard him?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. I believe Hitchcock Center is involved in that too. And speaking of the Hitchcock Center in Amherst, Saturday, February 9th, Animal Tracking with Colleen Kelly, Hitchcock Center for the Environment, 525 South Pleasant Street, Amherst. These family science days are designed for families with children 5 to 8 years old, with adults participating along with their children. For registration, call 256-6006.
And they're a lot of fun, even for the adults.
Cool.
I've loved them.
Great.
When I have time.
Monday, February 11th, 6 to 8:30 p.m., Citizens Awareness Network, our friends at CAN, a lobby training at 208 Roch Building at SIT in Brattleboro. Where's SIT? That's it's a college that does international training, I think.
Yeah, the School for International Training.
That's it. Yeah.
It's north of Brattleboro proper.
Yeah. Yeah. RSVP, Claire Chang, email cchang@nukebusters.org. And it says here, find out how a bill becomes law in Vermont and how to stop Entergy. Join us and learn more about the legislative process and how to win the ear of your legislator. These workshops are free, though space is limited. And Wednesday, February 20th, 8 to 11 p.m., Fear Sucks, The Dog Is Out, a benefit for CAN at the Mole's Eye Cafe, Brattleboro, Vermont. It's a book signing and a short reading, the world music improv magic of Mr. Derek Jordan, the kick-ass vocals and guitar of Kathleen Sims, and a special appearance by Debbie Katz, founder of CAN, our friend Debbie.
Yay. Yeah, Debbie.
And then finally, March 19th, and this actually is a whole week of events, but March 19th is a mass nonviolent direct action in Washington. And this is the anniversary, the 5th, would you believe, anniversary of the invasion and occupation of Iraq by the Bush regime. So there's also a no war, no warming action planned in conjunction with this important event. And to learn about that, you go to www.nowarnowarming.org. And to learn about all the actions built around the 5th anniversary, you can go to United for Peace and Justice or any of the local Peace and Justice websites. So that's important. Put that down on your calendar. March 19th is a mass nonviolent civil disobedience. And then before that, and the weekend before that, all kinds of actions and events.
March 19th is in D.C.?
In D.C., yeah.
The 19th is midweek, which is a good thing, you know?
Yes, that's the important one.
So take the day off. Take a bunch of days off.
Yeah, anybody wants a ride, let me know.
March.
You bet.
Yeah. Sit down and don't move.
I'm planning on going.
Me too.
Yeah.
All right.
I don't want a vigil anymore.
We should still have Valley Free Radio bus to go down or
something.
Wouldn't
that be fun?
Yeah.
That would be.
Yeah. 10 hours on a bus, though. It's tough. I did it last
you had fun.
Yeah, I had a great time. It's true.
All right. So go to our blog and check out links to that and all these things we just talked about. Just Google in The Enviro Show. You'll get there. Next up, as usual, is Hilltown Family Variety Show. Next week at this time, our sister show, Farm to Fork. And then we'll be back in 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
What are we going to be
I can't remember.
You wrote it down.
I wrote it down.
Oh, you have
somewhere.
The list there?
Yes.
Is it...
It's Dr. Will Tuttle.
Will Tuttle,
yeah.
Yeah, the
right.
Peace Diet.
The Peace, the World Peace Diet.
Yeah. All the reasons to go vegan.
Yeah. All right. That's a good one. That should be good.
And I invited the Food Not Bombs local folks to come and sit in on that too, but I haven't heard back from them. So if you're listening,
great.
Food Not Bombs, get back to us.
All right.
This is Dio saying so long. We're going to go out with Laura McKennett. Ancient Pines.
And I'm Glenn Ayers.
And I'm Jean Grossall. It's good night.
All right. See you in 2 weeks.
Vote, if you still time. Yes. Cast your vote.
Don't bother.